Hello, faithful listener, and welcome to the Small Voice podcast. I'm Holly.
And I'm Darren. And we're delighted to once again welcome long-standing friend of the podcast, Roz, to join us this month. Hello, Roz.
Hello, Darren and Holly. Nice to be here.
Well, it's good to have you back. This month, we'll be discussing the book Don't Forget We're Here Forever, A New Generation's Search for Meaning by Lamorna Ash, which came out in the spring and you might have seen has had a fair bit of media attention. We'll also have a wider discussion about some of the themes of the book. But before all that, let's check in on the team. Roz, you're our guest, so I'll come to you first. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I've just come back from a two-week holiday, which has been very pleasant. And it started out with a retreat with some friends who I normally meet at a coffee shop, and we always run out of time to chat. And we said, right, let's book Brayhead House, which is a little retreat centre near here, and we spent the whole day together, and that was lovely. And then my family went to Northern Ireland together, and which is your stomping ground, Holly, obviously, and saw the Giant's Causeway.
You have to say that you enjoyed it.
I did enjoy it. It was beautiful, and we realised quickly that you can access the Giant's Causeway out of hours and not have to wrestle through millions of people to see it. So that's my top tip about that. And then I'm now back at work, and we're planning all the things to do with Freshers Week at Glasgow University, where I'm one of the chaplains.
And what about you, Holly? How have you been?
So I don't want to be too much of a downer, but unfortunately the rest of life has been a bit overshadowed of late by work being really difficult. I don't want to go into any details, but I know a lot of our listeners will know the feeling of what it's like when things are tough at work. It can really suck the joy out of the rest of life. So one of the things I've tried to, I don't want to be too worthy because I was going to start talking about spiritual practices, but I shan't talk about spiritual practices. I promise I have had some. But one of the things I've been trying to do is have fun on purpose. And one of the ways that I've been doing that is by doing escape rooms. So since we discovered them at the end of June, so since we last recorded a podcast, my wife and I have completed 9 escape rooms across Glasgow and Belfast. I don't know whether either of you have done one before, but if you've not, an escape room is a game where you're locked in a room and you have to solve a series of clues and challenges to get out. Normally you've got an hour, maybe an hour and 15 minutes. And they have different themes and they're pretty elaborately decorated sometimes. And I find them so much fun. It's kind of like being in a logic themed game show. Hopefully the recordings never make it out of the companies that do them. So I've been okay. And doing a lot of escape rooms. So if you can't find me, I'll be locked in a room somewhere in Glasgow. What about you, Darren? How are you?
I'm fine. I'm just intrigued by that because I'm thinking that I'd probably quite enjoy the puzzly element of it. But there'd be part of me thinking that, you know, after the hour's up, they're going to open the door and say, you didn't manage to escape, at which point you'll be able to walk out anyway. So unless something awful happens if you don't manage to escape.
It does involve a slight suspension of disbelief. Yeah. We did one this week where you're meant to be trapped back in time in the Wild West, and you have one of the things you have to do is find the things in the room that are anachronistic. Now, obviously, there's a big telly on the wall that says how long you've got left of your escape room, and there's CCTV cameras recording you, and you know, electromagnets and stuff holding doors shut. So there's quite a lot of things that are
anachronistic,
but they're not the point of the game. But anyway, lots of suspension of disbelief. But no, so anyway, Darren, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I am I'm technically in my 60th year. I turned 60 in November, and when I was in my 40s, I did a fair bit of cycling. I cycled to work, which is kind of more or less 10 miles there and 10 miles back, so I was pretty fit. I won't say I was thin, but I was fit. And in my 50s, I've kind of become much more sedentary. So my excitement recently is that I've kind of started a fitness program. I don't know if you've heard of Couch to 5K. I'm not that energetic. I'm doing the easier version of that called Couch to Fitness. It's workouts that you do at home 3 times a week. I hate the idea of going to the gym but I've surprised myself by quite enjoying doing a kind of 30-minute workout three times a week at home, and feeling a bit better for it. So I'm rubbish generally at taking exercise or anything, but I think once I'm over the initial hump and it becomes a routine for me, I'm quite good at routines. So yeah, watch this space. I shall be a shadow of my former self in no time at all.
I'm sure I can drag you to a gym at some point, Darren.
I am not deadlifting.
Now, in our last podcast back in June, you may recall that Darren and I reviewed the movie The Salt Path, starring Gillian Anderson and Jason Isaacs. It's, of course, based on the author Rainer Wynn's memoir of the same name, which we also reviewed on the podcast back in 2019. As you may know, the Observer newspaper has recently run several articles questioning the authenticity of the memoir The Salt Path by Rainer Wynn, interviewing some of the people who knew Rainer and Moth and who disputed Rainer's version of events in the book. There's been talk of legal action, and as we record this, things are still a bit up in the air, shall we say. We'll provide a link in the show notes if all of this is news to you, so you can have a wee look at the Observer article and you want to dig a bit deeper. But I did wonder what our thoughts were on how this has all played out, because we have talked about the book and the film quite a lot. So, Darren, shall I come to you first?
Yeah, I mean, I was a bit disappointed in some of the allegations, shall we say, a little. But it's, I think I'm more disappointed in the way that people have just immediately said, oh, so it's all lies and it's all rubbish and it's all made up, and people who probably not even read the book. So I guess my general feeling is just of sadness, other than to say that I have listened back, I think, to our original review, and I didn't really care for Rainer Wynn's portrayal of her friends or acquaintances. I always thought there was just a little bit lack of generosity in that. And the same thing happens in the film where, you know, a friend or someone who knows them a little bit gives them a place to stay, but is not portrayed in a very kind of nice way. And that gets me onto the wider thing of, I don't think I could actually write one of these memoirs, because, you know, if you want to sell it, you have to have a little bit of drama, I guess. So some people have to be portrayed as... Not everyone can be nice. I don't know. I mean, Roz, am I right that you've read the book?
Mm-hmm, yeah, I've read the book, but I haven't seen the film. And I didn't dislike the book, but I didn't love it as much as lots of people I know love it. I think I bought it sort of coincidentally around the same time as I bought Wintering by Catherine May, I think. And I much preferred Wintering. My sort of claim to fame is that I managed to sell... I saw that the movie was coming out and I thought, I can get rid of my paperback copy on Vinted here. And I got rid of it for a fiver by saying that there was a movie tie-in with it. And I did that just before the scandal broke. So, yeah, I was feeling quite pleased with myself. But yeah, I saw, you know, some friends have posted about this on Facebook and how disappointed they were. And I guess it just speaks to that general sense of people worrying about authenticity, and in our fact-checking kind of era, that this is yet another disappointment and everyone is lying to us kind of vibe. And I get that. I get that kind of disappointment level. I wondered, though, you know, from your point of view, Holly, whether there was some stuff about the husband of Rainer Wynn, Moth Wynn, having a diagnosis and seemingly overcoming it by going on this very long walk.
I think so. Broadly, the accusations that have been brought by the Observer kind of fall into three categories, and one is that they, Rainer Wynn embezzled money, and that was part of the reason why they ended up losing their house. The second is that they continued to own property in France during the time that they were claiming to be homeless. And the third is this stuff that you were just talking about there, Roz, about Mothwyn's illness and his diagnosis of corticobasilar degeneration. It's really, that's interesting for me in general. I mean, corticobasilar degeneration, this is getting a bit medical, but is often called one of the Parkinson's plus syndromes. So it's like Parkinson's disease, but worse, or with different features. And I'm quite interested in movement disorders like that, because early onset Parkinson's is something that is in my family. And there was always something that felt a little bit off about the fact, and this sounds terrible, but there was something a bit off about the fact that Mothwyn was still alive and still able to walk around several years later, because that's not the normal path of this disease. And I think we all have a bit of a fascination with other people's medical problems in a way that's probably a bit unhealthy. So I think there's some complexity and nuance here, because I hate that Rayner and Moth felt that they needed to publish letters from doctors to verify Moth's diagnosis. I don't think that you should ever feel in a position where you have to publish your confidential medical records. I think that's terrible. But also, I think if you have an unusual disease and it's rare and people look to you as a representative of somebody who has that disease, but you find out somewhere along the way that the version of the disease that you have is not as bad as most other people have it, that there's probably some responsibility to say, you know, this is working for me, but I'm clearly not a normal, I'm clearly not representative of the people that have this condition. Mm. So I guess there's definitely some complexity here, because there's certainly no doubt that that Mothwyn has a form of corticobasilar degeneration. And there's no doubt that he's pretty well for someone who has that. But I can understand why people with a slightly more normal or usual progression of the disease would feel let down by the way that events have played out. So I guess as a doctor, it's kind of tricky. I don't know. I think there's so much complexity and nuance here that it's difficult to to summarize it. But I guess a question that I have for both of you is it important to you that a memoir like this is true? Like completely true?
Truthy.
Truthy, you know.
Yeah, I
factual.
I think the problem is more how the book is then used. So I've got real sympathy for people who have CBD and say, you know, I'm being told by my friends, oh yeah, read this book. All you need to do is go on a long walk and you'll be fine. Mm. And listen, that's not what Rayner Wynn is saying in the book, I don't think. That's my contribution. Mm. Ross?
Yeah, I think there's some onus on the publisher, isn't there, to check a backstory, and that seemed to be, there were question marks over whether the publisher had done that or should be responsible for that, and if so, to what extent. I think I want a book to be what it purports to be, and if it purports to be a true story, I want the whole thing to be true, I think. I wonder if to make it a good story, there's maybe even some pressure from the publisher to make a kind of redemption arc where this has to lead somewhere and people need to be made whole by the end. I don't know how much of that is wrestled away by the writer or how much editing can go into that.
But it's a fairly standard thing in a film, isn't it, to say, look, we have combined three or four characters in one person to kind of represent this particular thing. And maybe that also has been done by others. And I guess there is the question of, well, is this kind of pretty much standard practice? I mean, there was outrage that Rayner Wynn's real name isn't Rayner Wynn, but you think, well, like, if you're going to start having a go at authors for choosing a pen name, then you're going to be kept pretty busy. I don't know.
It is pretty funny that their surname is Walker, though. I mean, I find that funny. I guess my take, it's kind of along the same lines as both of you. I think there's certainly a duty of a memoirist to be authentic to their, even because you never have a completely accurate version of events. Nobody ever remembers their own life with 100% accuracy. But I do think if you're writing about suffering, illness, poverty, homelessness, you risk commodifying suffering and maybe undermining the experiences of other people who are going through those things if you do not hold to being as truthful as possible. But I guess we'll see what happens, won't we? Because I don't think that this is anywhere near fully played out.
No, it's not over yet. And faithful listener, if you want to get in touch with us with your views about the Salt Path or indeed anything else that takes your fancy, we'd love to hear from you. Remember, you can find us on Facebook or on our website at smallvoice.org.uk, and do please check out and subscribe to our Substack, which can be found at smallvoice.substack.com. Earlier this year, the journalist Lamorna Ash published a memoir called Don't Forget We're Here Forever, with the intriguing subtitle A New Generation's Search for Religion. I think it's fair to say that the book has caused quite a stir in Christian circles here in the UK, with positive and negative reviews and quite a lot of press attention. The book gives Lamorna Ash's account of engaging with many different forms of Christianity, from Alpha courses to Iona Abbey to Quaker meetings. It's a very personal work in which she interviews many Christians about their faith whilst making a faith journey of her own. In the introduction to the book, Lamorna Ash explains how her interest in all this started back in 2021, when she was looking for ideas for an article to write, and she chanced on the story of comedians, a stand-up duo, who had simultaneously converted to Christianity and were considering Anglican priesthood. She explains more in the introduction, which Holly is going to read from.
By the time my piece came out in late 2022, I knew I was not finished with Christianity. I say it scared me to witness how their conversion redefined the territories of their lives, the rooms of their houses. But I also found it astonishing, the way a conversion arrives like a volta in a person's life, an act simultaneously as destructive and constructive as falling in love, because ultimately it is a sacramental kind of falling in love. Perhaps it was naive not to have anticipated how spending my days alongside two fresh converts, attending services with them, speaking with them for hours about their faith, then spending many more hours ruminating on their responses, would have some cumulative effect on me. Through those encounters, it was as if the very corner of the sky had been pulled back. I couldn't see what was going on behind it, but I understood it was there for them, and that they perceived it as something vast and beating. This is how my conversations with two converts had changed me. They taught me how to believe in the belief of others. They wrecked my skepticism. Their stories became the starting point and pattern for what you're reading now. This time around in my research, I knew I had to travel more broadly. I wanted to seek out Christians who had taken as many distinct routes into and through, and occasionally out of faith as possible. But I also had another question turning in the back of my mind. Could anyone be converted into a religion? If I kept putting myself in the way of Christianity, would I eventually be converted?
Thanks very much, Holly. So, I saw the Guardian article about this book just before it came out. And I think I was quite keen to read it. I know you were as well, Holly. And I will say just straight out that I really enjoyed this. I think she's a good writer. And in dealing with a wide variety of Christians, I thought she was fairly generous. I think some of the people who are more in authority in certain circles of conservative evangelicalism, I think she maybe gives a tough time, but not to the people who are on the ground, as it were, I don't think. And I'm just thinking about it, you know, if someone said to me, have you got a reasonably modern book? If I'm even vaguely interested in thinking about Christianity, that isn't an Alf, of course, then yeah, I think I would happily recommend this book. What about you, Ros, in initial impressions?
Well, I didn't much like this book, I must confess. But I should probably explain that I come at this probably as generally a centrist. I don't do extremes, really, which probably comes from my fear of confrontation. But at the same time, I'm also pretty contrary. And I knew that the person who lent me this book loved it. I thought that you two would probably love it. And so therefore, I find myself deciding that I'm not going to like it, which is lame. But I thought, I should also explain that I am a Baptist chaplain and I attend or am a member of a church that would probably describe itself as evangelical. And I grew up in an evangelical church. So I kind of feel like evangelicalism is like my kid brother. Like, I can mock it gently, but nobody else can. And I didn't feel that she was especially fair to evangelicals. I thought she portrayed them in sort of simplistic ways, as if they were intellectually inferior to her. And I found that, but I did spend most of the book going, why am I struggling so much with this? Because she's arriving at conclusions that I have arrived at in my own faith journey. So what is my problem exactly? I thought, oh, you know, does she just write better than me? And I'm jealous of her because she does write beautifully. But I just felt maybe it touched something for me in, as I work in ecumenical circles where people kind of make an assumption that as a Baptist, I'm maybe not that smart or that I have no tradition, ritual, liturgy or anything useful to add to the conversation. And I feel quite sensitive about that at times, and maybe it touched that for me, and it wasn't really the book itself. The second reading I thought was a lot better, and I found bits that I was like, oh, she did actually say that, but that's kind of what I thought. What about you, Holly?
So I guess it's tricky, isn't it? I really love this book. You're right, you know, you could probably tell from reading it. It hits all my priors. It's kind of sometimes it reads a little bit like a book that was written for me. But I think the reason why I liked it so much was it went some way to answer some of my not my concerns, but my thoughts about whether a person like me, who wasn't a Christian already, could ever be convinced or converted to Christianity. Because I think actually in many ways Lamorna Ash is a bit like me. You know, she is a bit intellectually snobbish, and she is a bit, you know, we have things in common. She's queer, she's, you know, she runs in sort of similar circles to I would have run in at that age, apart from all the people that I was running with were also Christian, but they were the kind of Christian that I think Lamorna Ash would get on pretty well with. And I took some comfort in the fact that maybe if I came to faith now in my 30s, maybe I would still choose Jesus. Maybe I would still choose faith, even if it hadn't got me younger, if that makes sense. So I enjoyed it. I found myself finding Lamorna Ash as a person quite endearing as well, in her earnestness. I am interested in what you said about the portrayal of evangelicals, because I guess I find myself falling more with Darren around. I thought that she was pretty generous about most of the people that she met, I think I was reminding myself that a lot of the people that she met towards the beginning of the book at Christianity Explored or at YWAM were really young, slightly cheesy guys. And I think she did have a bit of a problem with young, slightly cheesy guys who were a bit clean cut. And I find those people reasonably easy to mock myself. So maybe it was the worst of me. She talks in the book about bringing the worst of herself to Christianity Explored, like wanting to needle people. And maybe I was bringing the worst of myself to that bit of the book. I was like, oh, I would quite enjoy having a bitchy conversation with you about how these blokes get up your nose. But I don't know.
It's an interesting style, though, isn't it? I mean, there are journalists, to use that phrase, or people who write a book about this who the focus is telling the story of the people. But in this style, Lamorna Ash is definitely, I'm not going to say she's putting herself front and centre, but it is a very personal work. And it does end up being as much about her journey as anything else. So I guess there's a duty to, be kind of relatively truthful. We're almost kind of, I'm not for a second going to compare Lamorna Ash to Rain or Wind, but there is that kind of making sure that you're being fair to people. I didn't, you know, and maybe this is my priors as well, Holly, you know, when she was describing an alpha course, and listen, okay, have I done an alpha course? No, I haven't. But, you know, I kind of know that the answers are in the back. You know, I kind of know that there's, you know, there's the answer and we'll have a good chat and all that. But be in no doubt, you know, that maybe, listen, I'm just being unkind. I mean, what do we think about her portrait of herself, if you like?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. I think as a gay person, I was really struck by the queerness in her, the way that she looked at the world. There's something about the orientation and the posture that she takes towards things. And I wonder whether some of that comes out in some of what she says towards the beginning of the book when she's speaking to people who are very different than her. There's a kind of watchful irony, I guess, like that kind of archness, queer archness that comes across where she's on the defensive in a lot of the conversations that she's in. And I was interested in that, and then how that kind of opened up as she, I think, did some of the more interesting writing to me is whenever she's speaking to individuals and like having meals with people and talking about the challenges of growing in faith. And she's very, very aware of putting herself into situations and that she, when she's comfortable and when she's not comfortable. So that was my take on her, how she placed herself. There was a kind of in-betweenness that she didn't want to, I think she was trying to keep some sort of journalistic distance and she didn't want to throw herself fully into it. And then sometimes it kind of snuck up on her anyway. I don't know. Roz, what do you, was me having a bit of a...
Yeah, I kind of thought that she was, I think I have the same problem with Lamorna Ash as I might have with Rain or Wind. I felt both authors are quite self-indulgent and it all came back to her and how she felt and this is how the Christian faith presented itself. And if it just presented itself like this, then I could believe it. And I thought, well, is that really what faith is about? You know, it just didn't seem like she was arriving at a point. I mean, she has moments of self-awareness, I think, where she says, actually, I realised that having spoken to that evangelical, I had no right to be angry. They had a right to be angry, but I didn't. But she still left it in the book, these descriptions of people as, they're very nice, those shiny, happy, sort of simple souls that they were. And I thought, well, you had an opportunity to revise that. Just putting in a little paragraph later to say, oh, maybe I wasn't very nice to them, it seemed a bit unfair. But it kind of arrives at points where it's what faith can do for her and what she would like to get out of it. And I didn't sense by the end of the book that she was saying, and I found a community. She does find a community, but she doesn't find a place where she can serve other people and think about people other than herself, other than very fleetingly. And I thought, I wonder how she'll look back on this in maybe 5 to 10 years' time when she reads this back. Will she go, oh, I was very early in faith then and I didn't understand this, this and this. She does get to some deep places, I think. But overall, I felt that it was quite spiritually immature even, if that's not desperately unfair. The person that she's hanging around with who was converted and wanted to become a priest, he's written an article about it and he doesn't pull any punches about, I think the article's called something like How Not to Find Faith, which is worth a read. I think it's in The Critic, which is quite a conservative magazine and not my usual fare at all, but I thought it was a well-written piece about this book.
I don't think it's unfair at all, because I do think that it is a memoir of someone who's kind of feeling around at the very beginning of faith. And we'll maybe get onto this later. It's not so much a review of the book, it's more kind of what some of the stuff that it brought up for me about what I was like at the very, very beginning of faith. And I think maybe it's easier to forgive a teenager who's like that, and maybe it's harder whenever you're hearing that kind of stuff from an adult. But it's an adult who is still at that very beginning. It comes back to queerness in some ways, actually, that we sometimes gay people are described as having a second adolescence after they come out, that they have to learn how to do relationships again. They have to kind of start from the beginning, and it often leads to people in their 20s making mistakes that we associate with 16-year-olds, and that is probably, it doesn't make us look the best. And maybe this is the Christian version of that. You know, I maybe made those mistakes when I was a bit younger. I'm interested in some of, she clearly wasn't having a very easy time of it in her personal life during the writing of the book. And she references her mother being unwell quite a lot. And I think that was something that I found quite interesting, because she was never, in the book, she's never particularly explicit about what's happening, but it's certainly a thread that's running through it. Is that something that struck either of you?
It certainly for me, I would say, yeah, Holly. In that, I think, you know, the book, I mean, okay, the book starts off as I'm going to write about all these other people, but, you know, the kind of the cliffhanger is, you know, what's her relationship going to be with faith at the end? You know, would she get to a point where she could call herself a Christian? But a subtext within that is her efforts or her desire to pray for her mum, but to really not know how to do that. And I remember when we spoke to Dave Tomlinson in a previous podcast, we'll put a link in the show notes, and Dave talked about, people using a stone for a prayer, and, you know, just different ways of praying. And I was quite moved by her description of how she eventually got to a point where she could pray for her mum, not necessarily with any great expectation of a miracle or not. It's a little while since I've read the book, but I did listen to a podcast today, the Reenchanted podcast. Again, we'll put a link in the show notes, where Lamorne Ash is interviewed. And what I found interesting in that, and maybe this is the kind of, now that the book's written, I'm looking back over it, she's asked quite a few times about, you know, different parts of Christianity, and, you know, what do you feel about people who would be more evangelical and so on. She does definitely come across as more measured and less judgy, if I can use that phrase, in that interview. It'd be interesting for you to hear that, Ross, and see if you come away at the end of that and still think, no. you don't talk about my wee brother like that.
Well, it was better in the second read, I think. I did laugh at the the part. I mean, I'm saying laugh. It was not funny. I thought it was very moving about the mum. But she does say, now that I know how to pray, And I was thinking, gosh, I'm not sure I know how to pray yet. Like, do you? You know, do you? you want to give me some tips? You know, yeah. I guess a lot of the students that I see don't know how to pray, and they ask me how it's done. And I think, well, here are some tools that you might use, but you kind of have to do it and try it and see how you get on. And I'm not sure I could ever say I know how to pray now. Thank you. Message ends.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would be interesting, but we will take a break, and we'll take a break for a jingle. Let me reassure you, faithful listener, no one is going to try and sell you anything during any adverts, nor are we going to do voiceovers for companies. But it's interesting maybe to talk about how people come to eventually participate in church, in faith, because I think, you know, in the book, she does end up finding a place, if you like. But and we probably will wind up there. I'm conscious that we haven't mentioned the Quakers much. Is that unfair? Should we be giving a quick shout out to Quaker meetings in the silence?
Yeah, the Quakers shout out that or bust her for co-modifying faith in order to write about it. I thought, yeah. Oh, that was perceptive.
And one of the things that I've been joking a lot about when I've been talking about the book is that I kept forgetting that she was still regularly going to a Quaker meeting, because she would kind of not talk about it for a while and then would talk about it. And I think, so Lamorna Ash goes to a Quaker meeting, I think, in Muswell Hill for the majority of the year that she's writing this book. And it is the Quaker meeting that her grandmother had attended at one point in her life. And I think that there's a wee bit of that kind of latent, there's a latent Quaker in her somewhere. I think that kind of, it kind of fits with her worldview. And you mentioned, Ros, about, you know, it's Quakers that kind of call her out for talking about, you know, writing a book about a faith journey. She talks about it herself. She talks about, like, do I want to say something in this Quaker meeting? Because I want to write about how it feels to say something in this Quaker meeting. And so I think big shout out to the Quakers, and big shout out to the Iona community. She wrote the extract about her going to Iona was excellent free press for them. So
it was interesting what she said about when her mother's diagnosis is made. She found the Quakers not the place that she wanted to be in that context. She wanted to be in a place where she was acknowledged and, you know, at least I can go to church on Sunday with this thing that's happened. Yeah. I thought that's quite interesting. That's that you then want something different when a crunch comes. And I wonder what different communities offer in different times of our lives.
Yeah. I'm guessing the Quakers, you have to do that over tea and biscuits afterwards, don't you?
No talking.
Says a person who's never been to a Quaker meeting. I did once go, not long after Jill and I got married, we did go to a little independent Baptist church, which was run kind of like a Quaker meeting. And it was just, you know, if anyone's got anything else to say. And boy, there was a chap there who saw his chance and took it.
Jump in.
We got about a 20-minute sermon. Anyway, it was nice. It was nice soup and bread afterwards. And you know what? They were deeply, deeply lovely people. We are going to move on to a more general discussion, but we will pause at this point to say, faithful listener, we'd love to hear your views on the book. You can tell it's generating a bit of discussion here, which is great. But just for your reference, don't forget We're Here Forever by Lamorna Ash is published by Bloomsbury and available in hardback and audiobook now.
So as we were alluding to at the end of the last section, one thing that we realised when we were reading Don't Forget We're Here Forever was that it brought up some bigger questions about faith and young people, and I guess what we might call mission, which is always a word that hasn't sat particularly comfortably with me, But we thought there were several rich and interesting things that we could chat about. One thing that really interested me, and as I mentioned before, was this thing about pathways into faith, and how does one become a Christian? And it made me think a little bit about my own journey, and also got me a wee bit nosy about you guys as well. I'll take one for the team. Go first. I came to faith whenever I was 15. And I came from a family that was kind of broadly agnostic. My dad's atheist. And my mum, you know, went to church sometimes but never owned a Bible. There was never a Bible in the house. And I came to faith through a big evangelical Christian festival in Northern Ireland called Summer Madness, which is a kind of a youth festival. I guess it would be similar to in vibe to things like Soul Survivor, or I mean, less like your kind of big Spring Harvesty kind of things, but more sort of youth orientated. And there were lots and lots of good things about Summer Madness, and also lots of damaging things as well. And that was my start in Christianity. And then I was really involved in a Presbyterian church when I was growing up. And then I kind of came out as gay in my early 20s and landed myself in a bit of a confusing place, and have been kind of a very, very much still a follower of Jesus. And I've never wavered. And there's definitely a love there that will not let me go. But I'm not the same kind of Christian that I was at the beginning. I also had quite a lot of healing to do from some of the stuff that happened to me predominantly between the ages of 15 and 19. So I always joke that I put myself into conservative evangelicalism, like it was my own fault. Nobody made me do it. And then I kind of had to sort myself out after I came out the other side of it. So that was my pathway into faith. And one of the things that struck me about the Lamorna Ash book was maybe this is a version of a queer person coming into faith and being able to kind of cut through some of the bits that would be potentially damaging to somebody in the LGBT community, shall we say. Anyway, that's me setting my stall out for my own pathway into faith.
That's your testimony.
That's my testimony. My testimony. I used to be a good Christian and now I'm a bit woolly.
Yeah.
End.
My dad was an elder in a congregational church only for a little while when I was maybe around about 10. I think I got baptised, not full immersion, you know, just a wee daub water on the head because they'd forgotten to do it earlier. But then pretty much, I think my mum and dad would say that they believed in God, but, you know, we weren't church goers other than that little brief experience. And then I became a Christian just at the end of a secondary school here in Scotland. Had a fantastic fifth year and then a kind of more challenging sixth year. And found, you know, a group of people that I really liked. And I mean, everything's intense at that age, isn't it? You know, that's part of the problem, I think. You know, you could look at a conservative evangelical church and say, you know, oh, it's too intense. But I mean, I think everything's in ultra UHD when you're that age. But I was thinking about some of the stuff Lamorna Ash writes about. I think she talks about the person who became a Christian walking through a forest, you know, through some religious experience. I am not that person. I think I became a Christian because of the people that I found at that small Baptist church, particularly the youth fellowship and friendships there, some of which continue to this day. I don't fully recognise who I was then, but what does intrigue me is whether I would have arrived where I am here had I not gone through that particularly intense experience, you know. I'm quite woolly now as well, Holly, but I don't know that there's a, you know, woolly Christians aren't particularly doing mission, if you like to use that phrase, bringing folk into the church. Or maybe they are. I mean, Lamorna Ash's book has been touted as this, well, this is a great clarion call for what we might do to get people into the church, which I think is, well, we can go down that alley if you like. There you go, Ros. I've presented you about three ways to go.
Oh, my goodness.
You can talk about that, or you can give your testimony.
I'll do my pathway to faith and where I'm now maybe, and then we'll come on to mission, can we? So I was kind of doomed to become a Christian. I think I grew up in a very Christian family. Two of my uncles were Presbyterian ministers. My maternal grandmother was a missionary in Africa and translated the Bible into Fulani with my grandfather. And so I became a Christian at a very young age. I was 11, and it was an American group that came over to our very small church plant, which is out of another larger church. And probably if I looked back on that 11-year-old, I would be horrified at what I was signing up to. You know, full-on Sinner's Prayer, Romans Road kind of thing. Became a member of my church at 16, was baptized at 15. And probably I didn't have too many questions about all of that and thought that faith was a very straightforward thing and you simply read the Bible and prayed every day and you'll grow. And it was probably only when I got to university the first time around that I really, really struggled. And later, you know, my early 20s were a real car crash for me, and it was only when I was in my late 30s that I had to sort of unpick some of the trauma that had happened to me in my early 20s, and that inevitably leads to a kind of reassessing of faith. Is this really for me? Similarly, when early in our marriage, we lost a baby and nobody seemed to have any answers about that. And, you know, there were just lots of different things that happened that you realised that the formula of putting a prayer in and getting a blessing out was not working. Why was it not working? Was there sin in my life or whatever? And so I think I now come to a new place and of course going to do some theological education kind of ruined you for enjoying worship because you're analysing it and thinking the exegetical approaches and thinking about the hermeneutics and all that. And but I still end up in churches that tend not to think very similarly to me about a lot of things because I love the people in those places. And that's what always keeps me. And quite often people approach faith in a way that I kind of fundamentally disagree with, but then they do something just so beautifully loving and kind that I go, well, they've got it. They've got this. And why am I judging people around me? Stop doing that. that's kind of where I arrive at these days in my almost 50s. Shocking.
I remember listening to a very young junior doctor once. It was probably about 10 years ago now. And she was kind of piously, I think, trying to evangelize someone else who was on a night shift with us. And he kind of knew that I was a Christian as well. And she did the, you know, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. My personal relationship with Jesus is really important to me. And then he kind of looked at me, and it was the middle of the night, and I was like, I think my corporate relationship with Jesus, like the relationship with God that I have in the community that I'm in, is really important to me, and I don't really understand what it means to have a personal relationship with Jesus. And I flip-flop a bit about that, because sometimes I do and sometimes I don't, but I think I'm I'm with you to the extent that it's the people in the church that keep me in the church. And Jesus. Big fan. But I joke about, you know, sometimes actually that it would be really, my life would be much easier if the grip wasn't so strong on me. Like I'm there no matter what happens. That's my life. I'm really grateful that I'm gay. It's one of the biggest blessings of my life, because it made me uncouple my identity from a bunch of stuff in my very early 20s that made me ask lots and lots and lots of questions about faith that I think were probably better dealt with as early as possible before I got too enmeshed in things that were going to become more difficult to unpick later. But I also think being gay makes me a more empathetic person. I think it is easier to empathize with other people who are treated as other if you have had an experience of being treated as other. Big fan of the people of God, it turns out.
I find this interesting because, you know, I mentioned that church when I was, you know, in my 20s, and then found a fantastic church in Edinburgh, which I still mourn. The church is kind of there-ish, it moved, but it's not quite the same place that it was, and had quite a bit of a kind of falling out with that church, if you like, because of what I thought was the behaviour at a corporate level to some degree. Then kind of fell out with God a bit. You know, my dad died when I was 29. My mum died, I'll get this wrong, 5-6 years after that. So, you know, I think I felt bad about that. I felt that was kind of very sinful of me to kind of blame God for it. And I'm not saying that I do blame God for it, but I kind of decided that God is big enough to cope with me being grumpy with God about it. And have, you know, I think because I was so involved in the church, and I'm looking at two people here, I know who will be very, very involved in churches. But because I was so involved in the church and it was such a traumatic experience when it all kind of messed up, I found it hard to commit to a church again. I think it would do me good to be in one, because I think maybe some of my rougher edges would get knocked off, and I wouldn't, you know, you would be not just hanging about with people. Well, I guess you're hanging about with Christians, aren't you? So you agree on something, but, you know, there's plenty to disagree about. And of course, there's a joy even of just having contact with people vastly different ages, different backgrounds and so on. But I found it hard to go back, you know. It's just a shame, I think.
I remember saying to our membership interview for the church that we're in now, the couple interviewing us asked us both, as happens in interviews, basically what gifts and skills that we were going to bring to this church. And I was at a really low ebb and said, I don't think there's anything at all that I can bring. I've got nothing. And most, you would expect that a church would say, well, I'm afraid membership might be out for you. And they said, but you will in the future, probably, won't you? And I thought it was such a kind way of dealing with me. And at the same interview, I said something along the lines that they wanted to know, you know, our faith journey and our story so far. And I said that I thought that you became a Christian over and over and over again. And again, I thought that would be the end of this conversation in this interview. And they were like, yes, we hadn't really thought about it like that. But yeah, I understand what you're saying. And it's that kind of graciousness that they would let you in, even when you felt that you had nothing to give, that I really value about where I worship now. But yeah, I totally get it that when it doesn't go well in a church, it can really sting you for future church going.
And do we think then, because there are, I'm not going to say there's a bandwagon that people are jumping on with Lamour Nash's book, but I think people are quite excited that this has got a reaction. You think, okay, this is reaching people who are not going to go to an alpha course. They'd rather read someone being arch about going to an alpha course. Like being kind. So do we think that I see, you guys will know, I'm not in the know, but people are talking about a quiet revival.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not going to purport to know a huge amount about it. There's a Bible Society report that I guess we can link to in the show notes about church growth in young adults, particularly in young men. So I have the key findings open in front of me in case I get it wrong. But in 2018, 4% of 18 to 24-year-olds said they attended church at least monthly. And today that has risen to 16%, with a notable rise in the proportion of young men attending, and with more men than women in the 18 to 24 age bracket going to church. There's a lot of conclusions being, there's a lot of chat in the church about the quiet revival. I don't know how much it means. It feels really hopeful. I think everybody, church growth feels like a myth in a lot of places. But I'm really interested in the use of the word revival. And I'd be really interested to know, when you hear that word, what you think it means, or what would a revival look like to you? Because I don't know whether we're all talking the same language. So I grew up in Northern Ireland, as we've talked about. There's a very well-known worship leader from Northern Ireland called Robin Mark, who has a song called Revival, that I happen to both love and have significant problems with. But it starts, as sure as gold is precious and honey sweet, you love this city and you love these streets. Every child out playing by their own front door, every baby laying on the bedroom floor. That kind of, revival, if people believed that God loved them, what an astonishing thing that would be. But then the rest of the song sort of goes a wee bit off a cliff. But I'm interested to know because I hear revival and it scares me a little bit, because to me, the kind of Christians that use the word revival are maybe not the kind of Christians I want there to be more of. And that's, again, it's my priors. That's my own my own problems there. But interesting to know what you guys think.
Well, for me, yeah, I think you and I maybe have a same reaction to that, in that, it's, like you mentioned, the Bible Society research, I'm thinking, what? If I was a certain type of bloke in America right now, in my late teens, God damn right I'd be turning up to church on a Sunday, it's what is being preached there, as a kind of male-dominated, kind of toxic masculinity. So I think you have got to be a wee bit careful about interpreting it. I'm not saying that's what's coming over here, although, in my experience from 30 years ago, Britain always did seem to kind of lag behind, America. What was kind of flavour of the month in the US would kind of come over here in 6 months or a year or stuff. I don't know if that's sped up a great deal because of the interweb. I don't know. I think I would like the kind of revival. If revival was like a U2 song, I think I'd be up for it. I'd be up for revival as a U2 song. How can I even explain this? Yes, something positive rather than, I guess there's revival and repentance. Jeez, that could be another thing. We'll go. Good luck to the person who's going to edit this discussion. That's what I was going to say. Ross, do you want to come in and say something clever?
Is it okay that I don't know what revival means? Well, I think I know what revival might mean to me, which would be that there was a great new understanding of who God is, and a movement that would enable people to discover God in a new way, that they would be made whole, that they would feel loved, that they would reach out to other people as a result of that, that there would be, you know, joy. And that would come with all the fruits of the Spirit of truth-telling and kindness and faithfulness and humility. And if it looked like that kind of revival, I think I'd be up for that. I'm not sure that that's what we mean, but I hope that that is what's happening, if it's happening. I guess my inherent cynicism says, you know, when numbers were low in churches and we were bemoaning the decline of churches, we said, oh, well, it's not numerical growth is not what's important. It's about depth of faith and spirituality. But suddenly when the numbers go up, we sort of betray ourselves and say, yeah, the numbers are going up though. And you know, make up your mind, which thing is it that you want? Do you want sort of more people in your church, or do you want more deep people in your church? And they might be two different things in two different demographics. It remains to be seen, I guess.
Be quite handy if the church said on the front door, like, we don't do deep. Yeah, that's great. I'm going there this week. You know, next week I want a bit of depth. I'll go there instead.
I think I'm going to just before I forget to say it, I've just read the lyrics to Revival by Robin Mark, and I've been terribly unfair, and it is actually still a certified banger. So please listen to Revival by Robin Mark. It is about laying down your burdens and God loving every person. And I think I could get on board with the kind of revival that you were talking about there, Roz. You know, if revival meant more of that community that we were talking about being drawn to, and loving acts and kindness, and if revival looked like what I think the Bible talks about whenever it talks about the kingdom of God, then yeah, like, sign me up. That sounds amazing.
And not old people's anxiety that the church is going to fall away after all their hard work keeping it going.
Yeah, I think I get a bit, I also get a wee bit tied up in knots around mission. You know, if I don't know what revival is, I definitely don't know what mission means anymore. So I talked about the atheist and agnostic bits of my family. I also have some absolutely wonderful overseas missionaries in my family. My great aunt and my second cousin, Fiona, particularly. And I think that there's a lot to critique about some of the ways that the church has approached particularly overseas mission in the past, and there was a lot of goodness and sincerity there too, and if we got into that we'd be here all night. But home mission, I guess, in the historic way that you would talk about it. The idea of evangelizing people always makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable, not because I don't want to share the good news of Jesus with people, but because I guess I'm quite I don't think we're saving anybody from anything particularly. I am liberal and fluffy and a bit universalist in my tendencies, so I think I can see an argument for seeing what God is doing and trying to join in. But the kind of traditional aspects of, I guess, what a church would define as mission, I find a little bit challenging. But we also need to keep a roof over our heads and have enough money to pay the minister. So maybe I should get over that.
I think I can be guilty of being critical of the established church for, maybe past sins, if you like. But you know what? On this podcast, we have a roving reporter, Margaret, talking a lot, interviewing people, the small voices, people who are making a huge amount of difference, even though they don't shout about it. And often that is people of faith. And so I think the word mission is really, really loaded and really difficult to use now. And it's awful easy to look at people who are working with the homeless and somewhat cynically say, well, you're just doing that because you want them to become Christians. But you know what? If you spoke to the people, I think you would find that they were doing it because this is how you should treat people. This is what you should do. And often it is the people of faith who are in there getting their hands dirty. And respect to them for doing that. You know, I'm not going out this Friday night, you know, as the street pastors, which I name that even that name makes it vulgar. But you know, these people are out there helping folk who've, you know, had a wilder night than they intended, and making sure that they get home safely.
Yeah, my church does quite a lot of mission that I think is not, I can't think of the word for this, sort of underhandedly trying to give a tract to somebody that has the gospel in it. You know, we, in partnership with a lot of churches in our area, we run a food bank. Up until very recently, we had a Christians Against Poverty Debt Centre. And it's involved in a really exciting project called East Kilbride Integration Network, which is welcoming the asylum seekers and refugees that are in a hotel near the church. And that's been a really exciting work. And so I would call those mission in the broadest sense of showing the love and compassion of God to people around us. And I guess as a chaplain at a public university, my senior management would be horrified if they thought that I was there on a mission of some kind. So it's all very indirect. And sometimes I have students who are in my room and they say things like, there just seems to be a good vibe in here. And I think, not anything to do with me, I think that they're experiencing something of the Holy Spirit, which I'm not in control of, obviously. And I do think that sometimes mission can come out of a certain anxiety about, we must tell people or they won't know. But if we believe in the God that we say we believe in, who is everywhere and above all and through all and in all, emphasis on all, I think we need to take some of that worry out of it and trust that people are being affected by God in ways that we just don't know about and we just don't understand. But in some instances, you get the privilege of facilitating an encounter with the living God, which is kind of amazing to be part of. So that's my kind of mission anyway.
I mean, I don't think I'm going to have anything to top that, although I am deeply disappointed that you don't control the Holy Spirit.
No, isn't that annoying?
Well, I hope that you'll agree that the three of us have solved all of the church's problems for this month. Certainly gone some way to making some hopefully kingdom-shaped suggestions. But I admit that we do have, probably between the three of us, have some blind spots. So we'd love to hear from you. What's your take on this? And maybe between all of us, everyone who's listening, we can maybe just sort everything out. And then we can go back to just hanging out with our pals. Anyway, thank you so much to Roz for joining us for this month's podcast. It's been a great conversation, and Darren and I love it. We've got someone else here to chat to because we're awfully bored chatting to each other.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's been great to see you, Roz. Thank you.
If you'd like to tell us what you think about anything that we've discussed in the podcast, you want to add to the conversation, as usual, you can get in touch via Facebook or our Substack, smallvoice.substack.com. But until next time, bye-bye for now.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.